Support is provided by Dr. Julie Peterman Bryant of the Bryant Clinic of Chiropractic and Acupuncture in Bismarck. Naturally working with people to feel better, be healthy, and live well. Capital Shakespeare of Bismarck, in partnership with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, presents Julius Caesar, July 21st through the 25th, 7 p.m. nightly. Chicago guest director Steve Grossman examines the envious Roman society in the time of civil war and unrest. Is Brutus an honorable man who helps kill Caesar for just reasons? Also, the Young Bards Theater Group will do a pre-show performance each night entitled Shakespeare Our Way, directed by Aaron Weckel. Capital Shakespeare on the lawn, July 21st through the 25th.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. Doug Hamilton is on medical leave. Coming up in the second half of today's show, we have a couple of our regular Friday guests. News director Dave Thompson joins us to talk about the week's biggest stories. And Matt Olien reviews the new movie Roadrunner, a film about Anthony Bourdain. And of course, Anthony Bourdain, quite famous for his approach to food. We are going to start today with a conversation on the future of food. Joining me from our Bismarck studio is Daryl Oswald, one of the organizers of the event and one of the managers of the Minokin Farm outside of Bismarck. Daryl, thanks so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you for having me. I appreciate the opportunity to talk about our upcoming event here on August 4th, the future of food.
And that event is 5 to 7:30 at the Heritage Center in Bismarck. A pretty provocative title there. Why did you want to call it The Future of Food?
You know, when we plan these events, we get together and brainstorm on, you know, what way we want to move forward. And as a group, we thought it was catchy and, like you said, very provocative. And it would catch people's attention because what is the future of food? What is our food system like now? And, you know, where are we going? And these three speakers that we have will hopefully make it a little clearer for us.
Well, let's talk about some of those speakers. Let's start with Dan Kittredge. He is an organic farmer. He's been doing this for about three decades now. Founder and executive director of the Bio-Nutrient Food Association. I assume he was brought in to talk about nutrient density.
Well, he was. And, you know, this isn't the first time we've had Dan here in North Dakota. This is actually the third time, and each time he's come, the excitement level and everything has increased. And it is just what you said. He is the founder and executive director of the Bio-Nutrient Food Association, and he is a real believer in nutrient-dense food. And so that correlates into having healthy soil, healthy plants, healthy animals, healthy food. And he's actually been working on a, if I might ad lib a little, a bio-nutrient food meter that the consumer someday will have in their possession, and they'll be able to actually determine the nutrient density of the food that they purchase. And so it's cutting-edge stuff.
Wow.
Dan is a very dynamic guy. He'll capture your attention. He's got a lot of energy. Just excited to have him back again with us, and it'll be great.
Well, it's pretty obvious. You know, people know, okay, a Pop-Tart, this is not a healthy meal. But when you talk about nutrient density and then say things like soil health, how does what the soil is like impact the difference between, let's just pick a potato, one potato to the next?
Well, obviously, I think the soil would be considered the foundation. And we're finding even at the Minokin farm, our demonstration farm, that what we can do with healthy soil and correlates into healthy food. And there's just a connection there that occurs because a lot of times in today's production model, whether it's large or small scale, we're working with a degraded resource. And, of course, the foundation is the soil, and we need to get that right before we can move forward and get the healthy plants that are in the soil, have the healthy animals consume the healthy plants, and then, of course, all of that becomes part of what we eat. And so it's very complex, very fascinating. We went down this road a while back, and, of course, every day and everything that we do, it really opens up a lot of new surprises and avenues.
Another speaker you're having, Joel, is it Salatin?
Yeah, Joel okay. Salatin. Again, Joel is a bring back. We actually helped sponsor him at the North Dakota Association of Soil Conservation District's recognition banquet a couple years ago. And just another dynamic force, probably the foremost direct marketer of meat and vegetables in the United States. Polyface Farms, great author. He's got some wonderful books. He's had 13 books out, and I've been able to read a couple and have visited with Joel, and a great teacher. He's got an intern system there at his Polyface Farms that I believe is second to none, and he's teaching and educating people and then putting them out into the world, and you know, he's their teacher. And obviously when it becomes, we talk nutrition and nutrient density, availability is key, and we have to have the Joel Salatins of the world to provide this food, and we have to have the Joel Salatins of the world to teach others how to grow their own food. And that moves into the locally grown and all those other things that come along with it.
You mentioned that he has written 13 books, and one of them highlighted on the pamphlet for this event is, Folks, This Ain't Normal, A Farmer's Advice for Happier Hens, Healthier People, and a Better World. Are you familiar with this book?
I am a little bit, okay. And it's quite a read. If you know a little bit about Joel, or even a lot, he's got a chicken production model, whether it's hens and or broilers, that is really captured the imagination of the people. And it's his main driving income source, just with these chickens. And so he's able to heal the land. He's able to provide food. He's able to provide nutritious eggs. He's able to do all these things, and of course he's got these people that work for him that, you know, it's a circle, and, you know, it's a circular system. And that's somewhat what we're lacking in production agriculture today, is that circular system that comes back around, whereas a lot of times today we're more of a linear system, and I think, and others think that, you know, we somewhat need to get away from that.
Let's dive a little deeper into the differences between a circular system and a linear system. So let's go with that larger scale production ag versus the subsistence scale model first. What do you mean when you say a circular system? And what's an example of
linear? I think it's more of a holistic approach to your thinking, and you think in ecosystem function. And so what affects one thing affects another thing, affects another thing, affects another thing, and it all comes back around. And of course, it supplies itself, it nurtures itself, and it's a sustainable model. And we as humans, and that's another aspect that we like to talk a little about, we like to simplify things. And of course, we simplify the landscape, and that leads us to this linear thing. And the best example I can give you is like a pipe. And so you've got something going in one end of the pipe and out the other. And if you want more things out the end of the pipe, what do? You put more things in the other end of the pipe. And along with those things, obviously you have water quality, you have nutrient issues, you have herbicide resistance and all those things that come along with putting more things in the end of the pipe. Now, it's a model where production can be very huge and you can feed a lot of people, but we need to look more as food as a medicine as well. And that's where I think the circular system where it moves and flows in a circular manner and comes back long term is definitely what you're going to see in the future and what is definitely sustainable.
The big push behind these production ag things is what you mentioned, that we are feeding people. There are 7 billion people in this world. And when you talk about these models, it always came down to a question of yield. Can you get the same kind of yield when you use this holistic approach?
I think eventually we can move towards that. I'm not sure on the timeline on that, but what we have to actually take into consideration is how long can we continue to do what we're doing now when we're working with a degraded resource and we continue to degrade it. And so I look long term and is the more circular, holistic approach where you look as the ecosystem function as a whole really sustainable? Well, I believe it is because this was occurring long before. And of course, it's human nature to want to simplify things. We do that as humans, and there's nothing wrong with it. It doesn't make anyone evil, but we tend to gravitate towards that. But we also have a lot of unintended consequences that go with that. And so I would like to think that as we get closer and for lack of a better term, perfect the model holistically, that I think we can feed the people. When you look at high tunnel gardens and some of the things that people are doing, it really amazes me how much production we can get out of them. And I think we have to look at, too, is we have to educate people to feed themselves, and that's a whole different concept as well. And I think if we move toward that, and I think these individuals that will be speaking on the August 4th will give you some indications that that can be a positive thing, and that's the way we need to think moving forward. So.
This event, again, is coming up Wednesday, August 4th from 5 to 7:30 p.m. at the North Dakota Heritage Site. There will be 3 speakers on the future of food. We are visiting with Darrell Oswald, one of the organizers of the event and one of the managers of the Minokin Farm, a demonstration farm in part managed by the Burley County Soil Conservation District. Darrell, when it comes to understanding the multiple parts of a healthy food chain, do you find more openness to your approach from the consumers or the producers?
Well, that's a good question. I would think, as I reflect on that a bit, I think it's from the consumers because people have become concerned or they're inquisitive in the fact that where their food comes from, is it healthy? Is the individual that's raising my food, are they doing things the right way? And so that trend has been coming along. So that, in my mind, makes the consumer more readily acceptable of this ecosystem, this holistic approach, this regeneration mode that we try to move forward with some of the things that we do. The producers, I believe we're gaining all the time. We have some very open-minded, very thoughtful producers that are doing some wonderful, wonderful things. And I think sometimes, too, we don't give enough credit to those individuals. And let's be honest, there's a lot of peer pressure in what we do. And so, you know, if your neighbor sees something that you're doing that maybe not be quite what they're used to seeing or is out of the ordinary, and, you know, it kind of goes down the chain. And so whether you're a gardener or you're in a larger scale production model, that peer pressure is real. And it's something that needs to be overcome. And I think it's groups, it's events like this that give people not only hope, but I think it gives them some fortitude moving forward to let them know that they are moving in the right way. And it's a team approach. You need a support network. We talk about that a lot at the Minocan Farm, that we need a support network to the individuals that come out there. And, you know, we hope to be part of that support network. And it can be from anyone or anybody. And that's the exciting thing about it. So producers, yes, we're moving forward with the acceptance. And quite honestly, I think the consumer is going to drive this.
Sure.
Because they are in control.
They got the money.
They do. They have the money and they have the people. And as you know, when you look at any kind of type of agriculture, we're a very, very small population percentage of the population. And so, you know, they're going to be the driving force, I believe, going forward.
Give me an example of someone Darrell Oswald is watching in the state in terms of a producer that you just really admire.
You know, there's a whole bunch of them as you move from east to west across the state. We've had some wonderful presenters come to some of our events that are from North Dakota. The large-scale producers, the Joe Breckers of the world, the Dana Fletchers, the Jeremy Wilsons out east, and you move into the central North Dakota, you know, Blackleg Ranch, of course, Gabe Brown. Many people have heard of Gabe. He's really quite a force in this regenerative. Mm-hmm. And as you move out west, you've got Derek Dukarts and Josh Dukart and the Jacobsons and others. And again, I missed a lot.
That was pretty good for me just putting you on the spot there.
It is. And I know a lot of them because we work with those people.
Yeah.
And they're part of our team. And that's what I mean about the support network. And so there's a lot of producers on the gardening end. You know, obviously there's a lot of people moving forward that are doing the locally grown aspect of it.
A lot of farmers markets too.
There is, and they're doing it the for lack of a better term, the right way, and doing it in a regenerative manner. So
the last speaker at the Future of Food is a guy who wrote a book called The Dorito Effect, The Surprising New Truth About Food and Flavor, Mark Schatzker. Why a guy who writes about Doritos when talking about the future of food? Are you saying this is where we're headed?
Well, no. Mark is another individual that we had at the Farming and Ranching for the Bottom Line a year or so back, and we just thought that he was a great fit for what we're going to do. Again, very dynamic speaker, has devoted a lot of his time and resources into discovering the truth about how nutrient density and flavor and how the soil is treated and how the plant and animal and all that connection and how that affects flavor. And it's truly, truly fascinating. His other book, Steak, The One Man's Search for the World's Tastiest Piece of Beef.
Tough assignment.
You bet it is. And a very interesting read. But under the same premise of going around talking to people, interviewing, looking at every production model imaginable, and then turning his attention to which piece of beef was the tastiest and what, how did that correlate into the production model of where that came from. And truly, it's fascinating. It just makes you think. It makes you also realize there's so many things in this regenerative and this nutrient density and this soil that we don't know. And I always tell young people, and we host quite a few groups of young people out at the Minocan Farm, agriculture right now is very exciting because of just the things that we're talking about. And it's all related, and that's what's very, very exciting. So, yeah, we're just pleased to have these individuals come to the event. We're looking for a good turnout and to really get some information and education out there that can really help some people moving forward. And, you know, this human health thing in America and across the world is huge. And yeah. And it, we have to wonder sometimes, is it have to do with, you know, obviously, you know, we don't maybe treat ourselves the way we should, but does it have to do with the way we eat and what we eat? And so I think this event, too, will help explain a little bit of that, and it, because it's all tied together. And finally, the other thing is if we're going to move forward with this, what's going to be the availability? And is there going to be enough of it, like you said? You know, and what's going to be the price? Because obviously we want consumers to be able to have the same opportunity across the board. And so price becomes in effect. And so I think as we make it more mainstream, I think that's how supply and demand is going to affect the price. And as you get more locally grown, you know, again, going back to teaching people how to feed themselves. So.
And we don't have time for it today, but at some point that conversation needs to include, too, just how much do we really need to be consuming. The Future of Food event, the speakers will be from 5 to 7:30 p.m. on Wednesday, August 4th at the North Dakota Heritage Center in Bismarck. There will be a social starting at 7:30 featuring local foods from Terra Nomad in Bismarck and Duchessa Gelato of Carrington. Daryl Oswald is one of the organizers of the event. Daryl, thanks so much for your time today.
Well, thank you for having me. I sure appreciate the opportunity. So hope to see everyone out there.
Still to come on Main Street, we have our conversations with Dave Thompson and Matt Olean that we have every week. But now it's time for the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. Continuing protests over the Enbridge Energy Pipeline replacement project has led to the rare closing of a state highway. The State Patrol and MnDOT have shut down a portion of Highway 32 between Thief River Falls and St. Hilaire.
We're working in conjunction with local law enforcement, but we're just working to assist. Our main goal is the traffic safety portion on Highway 32. There's campsites, there's people that are up there staying in that area, and with the amount of cars that are parked in the area, it's a public safety hazard for traffic and people being able to travel safely on Highway 32.
State Patrol Lieutenant Gordon Shank says the closure will be in effect until further notice. Residents will be given access to their property and homes, and pipeline demonstrators will be able to leave. Pennington County Road 17 has been established as the detour route. The North Dakota Board of Higher Education has gave UND the green light to utilize a private developer to remodel and build new residence halls on campus. In addition, many existing apartments will be phased out and demolished over the next 11 years. Under the plan, McVeigh and West would be raised in favor of a new complex. Brannon would undergo a full remodel and upgrades would be made to Selkie and Norin. The board authorized UND to borrow $136 to $140 million in 40-year tax-exempt certificates at an interest rate of 2.96% to fund the project. UND Vice President of Finance Jed Shiver says the goal is to improve on-campus living for students while right-sizing future housing needs.
First, it creates the quad Secondly, it creates connectivity across all these buildings. And then lastly, it creates the volume sufficient so that when we're finally finished, we'll have students eating at Wilkerson. We'll be able to close our second dining center in Squires, and that will reduce operating expenses by about $1 million a year.
In a separate motion, the board authorized UND to demo 29 apartment buildings and 6 residence halls. The move is designed to reduce operating costs. A staff report says the resident halls alone have over $61 million in capital needs. And the North Dakota Department of Transportation has added a number of kiosks around the state where people can get vehicle license tabs and apply for driver's license renewals. There are 52 of those kiosks now. Brad Schaefer is the director of DOT's Driver's License Division. He says they're at strategic locations.
We took a map of North Dakota and then took the population, and we broke it all down by where all the vehicles are registered, where all the licensed drivers are at, and we picked the locations that had typically a lot of people in them, and also we wanted to make sure that every kiosk was strategically placed in the state so people could at least drive to one that was very close in their area.
Schaefer says the kiosks only accept credit or debit cards and says people like the convenience of not having to go to a DOT office. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by AARP North Dakota. Looking for ways to safely stay active, healthy, and informed without leaving home? AARP North Dakota has lots of online offerings. Learn more about the ways you can stay connected to your community at aarp.org/ndevents. On Prairie Public Primetime TV tonight.
We released a rather daring record.
Suddenly we were in demand. Suddenly we weren't going to be in debt.
They pushed the technology to its very limits.
It was a major step in Queen realizing what they could do. And, of course, they went on to do it.
Watch classic albums Queen, A Night at the Opera, tonight at 9 Central, 8 Mountain on Prairie Public.
There's the old teletype machine. That means it is time to talk to our news hound. News director Dave Thompson joins us once a week from our Bismarck studio. Dave, thanks.
You're very welcome, Ashley.
You had a story and then an update to a story on some rates being
considered for XL.
Right.
And what happened is XL filed a more than 10% rate increase for electricity. They filed that back in November. And then they cut it back to 9.3%. That happened in March. And now, after negotiations, they're settling on 3.4%. So it is quite a bit reduced from what originally proposed. What will go into this? It'll cause your bill to go up by about $2.50 a month from where it was last November. And I have to explain that because it's a little bit complicated, but what they'll do is there's going to be a base charge, which is now $14.50 just to get the service into your home. They're going to add 50 cents to that and make it $15. And then they'll raise your rates based on what you paid back in November by about $2.50. Well, what happened after the Public Service Commission got a look at it and XL reduced it the first time, they were granted interim rates, which you can do.
Right. And that was around 5-ish percent, I think?
Something like that. It was 5 to 7%. And now there's going to be a refund because the final rate is lower than the interim rates. So customers of XL Energy who are residential are going to expect around a $26 refund. So it's a complicated process, but it's the way it has to go.
Yeah.
And what happened is there were a lot of interveners in the case. Walmart was an intervener. AARP of North Dakota was an intervener. There were other interveners. They negotiated it out. They hashed it out, and they came up with 3.4%.
Yeah, I wonder this ask of 10.8% and finalizing on 3.4, how much of that is XL was just asking for a lot, and how much could that really come down upwards of 7%?
There is probably part of that, but what they did not figure in, there were some other mitigating factors. For example, XL receives a yearly refund concerning storage of nuclear, spent nuclear facility.
Mm.
and they have to store it on site so they get paid by the federal government for that. So some of that goes back in to benefit the rate-paying consumers. So that was figured into it, and also there were other things that talked about demand and talked about service and talked about taking some plants offline. There's a lot of things that go into it. These cases are really complicated. And
yeah, they take months.
They take months to solve. And apparently now, probably within the next maybe 30 to 60 days, the PSC will come to a final decision on it. But it looks like 3.4 is going to be the final number.
What was Walmart or AARP? You said they were interveners. Why were they weighing in?
AARP does that because they worry about low-income households. Okay. And if you bump them up by 10%, that's going to put a real squeeze on them. Walmart's a big user, so you might expect they're a little concerned about paying a lot more in terms of their power demands.
Okay. The North Dakota Mineral Resources Director, Lynn Helms, used not an encouraging phrase if you're talking about making money anyway, flat as a pancake in terms of oil production growth.
Right. That's April through May. It was absolutely flat, just up by about 4,400 barrels. Now, Lynn Helms was a little concerned about that. He said the prices are looking better, so you'd think that there would be more drilling activity. Well, the trouble is there's a lack of frac crews out in the Bakken right now. There are only eight working. A lot of the frac crews that were working before the pandemic hit, they moved when the pandemic hit back to Texas and New Mexico, where they're probably from. So now they're looking at, you know, trying to recruit people to come back if they can. But if not, they're working on maybe homegrown things. They're going into the high schools or the colleges and saying, hey, you trained for this. This is very good paying work. So they're hoping to attract people that way.
Other incentives besides the wage?
Not at this point, but there's some talk about it. There's some talk about maybe having housing incentives or some other incentives to drive. If you have to drive to work, you know, paying mileage and stipend for mileage. A lot of things that are being discussed to try to get people back into the Bakken.
Okay. This might be a little outside the scope of this story, but, you know, I said that for people who are trying to make money, they don't want to hear flat as a pancake. But other people would be a little bit excited that there is less oil production in the state. Maybe some environmentalists does anybody excited about this?
Well, they haven't really come out and said it yet because I think it's just sinking in that these things have you know, are slowed down a little bit. Okay. The one thing that the environmentalists might be excited about is that we have a goal of 91% capture and we're above that of natural gas.
Okay.
So
okay.
Flaring is down, which is a good thing. And they're worried if you spike up drilling, there's going to be more flaring of natural gas.
A few higher ed stories to talk about. The person heading up NDSCS is retiring, President John Richman.
I find that an interesting story, and there are some unanswered questions there. John Richman was given a pretty good evaluation. I would say a sparkling evaluation by the Chancellor Hagerot from the university system, and it looked pretty good. But the board decided to give him $100 a month raise. Now, that's the minimum the legislature put in place for all state employees. No one could get less than $100 a month.
Mm-hmm.
And other people in the university system, presidents, got 1.5% or higher.
Okay.
Now, part of what I learned is that John Richman was at 103% of the national average for colleges in his, you know, size range.
Okay.
So they were looking at maybe holding back on that. And, you know, I think he's to the point now he's maybe looking at retirement as a pretty good option at this point.
We are already starting the search for who's going to replace Bresciani.
Right. And remember, Dean Bresciani was given an 18-month contract.
Right.
And after the 18 months, he goes in as tenured faculty at NDSU. Well, that's 18 months from now, but they're going to get the search started because the feeling among the board and the chancellor is that the NDSU job is going to be a pretty good job, yeah. pretty attractive for people. So they're getting the search started. They've got a board member and an NDSU vice president who are going to head up the search committee. Now, what was interesting at the board meeting is that one of the new board members, Jeff Volk from Fargo, made a motion that he be put on the search committee, and it failed for a lack of a second. He brought up that there was some real concern among people, especially in the downtown Fargo core, about Brashani leaving with an 18-month contract. So they said there's some concern there, and there's some concern who will replace Brashani at NDSU.
And UND, there is some construction happening here.
Now, this is a fascinating story, and I really want to get into it, and I want to get up to UND because I am a UND grad.
Mm-hmm.
They're really concentrating a lot of the student housing in the one core around the Wilkerson Center. They're tearing at least two dorms down there, but they're also adding on to dorms, and they're building some new. And the housing is going to be concentrated there. Some of the other dorms are going to be torn down and other quads, and also some of the student housing that's, you know, apartments, that's going to be torn down too. Because a lot of that has, you know, been suffered from deferred maintenance, and it would take a lot to get those things back to code. Also, the new housing setup at UND is going to be more attuned to what students are looking for these days, you know, instead of, you know, a room with bunk beds or looking for like efficiency type apartments.
Do we have a total cost on what's happening right now?
It's going to be $136 to $140 million to do this. Now, what's going to happen is UND is going to sell bonds, and Johnson Controls is going to actually take over the bond payments. So it's a very interesting plan, and it deserves a little bit more scrutiny and well, not necessarily scrutiny because – you know, it looks like a very good plan, but it's to those of us who are familiar with the college campuses, it's quite fascinating what's going on mm-hmm. with UND. And if you look overall, it's getting rid of more than a million square feet of space.
Wow. Because of lower enrollment?
Well, it's lower enrollment and concentrating into one quad area.
Okay. And I would imagine there has to be some kind of tech upgrades when they talk about these changing buildings.
Absolutely, there's going to be tech upgrades. They're going to have to be wired for latest high-speed internet, and they will come pre-wired.
Chargers and everything.
Chargers and everything. So there'll be a lot of modern conveniences going in there.
One modern convenience, 52 kiosks across the state that you can use to renew your tabs and even get a driver's license?
Correct. The North Dakota Department of Transportation started this as a pilot project and put a few kiosks around the state, but they turned out to be very popular. So they've added kiosks. Now they've got 52 around the state. And originally, the kiosks, you could go get your tabs for your mm-hmm. motor vehicle licenses. Well, what they are now going to do, you can apply for your driver's license renewals at these kiosks. You can't get them printed there,
okay.
but in a few days you'll get it in the mail. But you can scan documents. You can put in all your information if you need a renewal.
What's the security on something like this?
Oh, there's
a lot of sensitive information.
A lot of sensitive information, but they have built-in security and encryption. And these are in places that are well-lit. And, you know, like in convenience stores, things like that.
Just a few seconds left. Can you apply for the real ID on one of these?
I asked about that and not yet, because there's going to be some new guidance coming from federal officials about applying for the real ID at these kiosks.
Oh, yikes. All right. Well, we'll check in with you again next week. Thanks.
Thank you, Ashley.
In the mood to hear something uplifting and beautiful? Then join host Jason Thomes for Dakota Sings on the next Prairie Public Presents. You'll revel in the joy of choirs from North Dakota and beyond as the uniquely human tradition of singing together in front of other people makes a comeback.
This spring was an exciting time for choirs across the region as COVID-19 restrictions started to be loosened and choirs started to be able to perform in person.
Hear Dakota sing Sunday at 5 p.m. Central, 4 Mountain on Prairie Public.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
When you hear the fanfare, you know it's time for another movie review with our in-house film critic, Matt Olien. Matt, you've been to see Roadrunner, a film about Anthony Bourdain, of course, the late food connoisseur and host of several programs on television. And for starters, why is it called Roadrunner?
Because he was on the road all the time. They traveled all over the world. The director, Morgan Neville, I guess, chose that title. He was on the road 250 days a year the height of what he was doing for Parts Unknown. And then before that, the show was called The Cook's Tour. So Bourdain's fame really happened with a book he wrote called Kitchen Confidential in 1999, which was about his years working in restaurants as a chef. And all of a sudden, they want him to host a show, a travel show. And it became a huge deal. He became very good at television. He was very good on the air. He was very engaging. Mm-hmm. The real Anthony Bourdain, you know, could be different than that. And that's what the documentary tries to explore is what really, who was he? What led to his suicide? You know, questions are raised, things like that. So many, many people are interviewed. Friends, people on the film crew that worked with him, acquaintances, his first wife. His second wife, who he was estranged to but still married to when he committed suicide. So it's very interesting. It's a little too long, at 2 hours long. I think it could have been hacked down. But it's interesting when you're watching it. But as someone who's made 12 or 13 documentaries, I did have some issues with it. The main issue that's being talked about by a lot of people is the fact that in several email reads, so there's emails that Bourdain wrote in his lifetime, and you hear him kind of narrating and reading the emails.
Right.
But on several of those occasions, it's not him. It is artificial intelligence audio that Neville did to make it sound like Anthony Bourdain. I think the big scene where I have a real problem is his friend, who's an artist, is reading an email that Bourdain sent to him a couple years before he died. And the friend is reading the email and tearing up as he's reading it. And suddenly the shift changes from the friend's voice to Bourdain's artificial intelligence voice. Why not just let the guy read the email? I don't understand that. Ethically, I have some issues with what he did. So does Bourdain's widow. She has weighed in on this.
It kind of hit me in the gut when you said AI person.
Yes.
You could have an actor read those.
So we know everything about Bourdain in terms of, you know, where he died, when he died. Without giving away too much of the film, though, Neville has also come under criticism for the last 2 or 3 minutes of the film and how that is staged, almost like he was making a narrative film. So that's another problem I have with the film. And finally, Assia Argento is not interviewed in the film. She was his girlfriend, the Italian actress, when he committed suicide. And Neville has said, I didn't want to go down that rabbit hole, but everyone else is in the film and she has given interviews. So if you're going to go right up to the line, and, you know, at the time when he killed himself, she had been seen in the tabloids with another man. So if you're going to go right up to the line and almost but not quite implicate her in his suicide, I would reach out to her and give her a chance to talk. And he never did reach out to her. I think that's a big hole in the film, is that she's not in the movie. So those are the big three things I had a lot of problems with ethically as a documentary filmmaker. Look, it's interesting while it's on. It raises a lot of interesting questions about life. There's a tremendous soundbite by one of his friends who's a rock and roll performer who says, he says to Anthony Bourdain in this old clip, he says, it's the blessing and the curse. There's nothing better than getting home and nothing better than leaving home. Mm-hmm. And I think that was Bourdain's, he wanted kind of that family stable life, but he also liked to be on the road. And you almost can't have both at the same time. So there was that blessing and curse in his life. He's a former heroin addict as well. And a lot of his friends talk about he was chasing that next addiction. whether it's travel or doing this or doing whatever. Why he killed himself, we'll never know. But it's an interesting film while it's going on. I just had some ethical issues with how Neville constructed the documentary.
Well, yeah, I wonder, is there even such a thing as an ethics commission when we're talking about a film that's going to go out to millions of people?
No, there isn't. Documentary filmmaking is very different from news reporting. It is, you can make an agenda documentary. You can make any documentary you want. As long as you can get distribution, you can have that film out there. So he can make whatever film he wants to make. He's been a little defensive on the AI thing. He's been a little defensive on why he didn't reach out to Asia Argento. And look, he's a major talent. 20 Feet from Stardom, great documentary, Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood. Those are they're great documentaries. This one, I think, could have been great, but I think he had a little bit of a sleight of hand that maybe kind of it's like the guy who's dealing the deck of cards and you can't tell what's going on, and then you find out later what the sleight of hand was, and it's kind of like Wizard of Oz, man behind the curtain.
Mm-hmm.
Oops, maybe that wasn't the best choice to make, but it was his choice to make as a documentary filmmaker.
Does it go into what I would assume are probably some mental health concerns? That's pretty common among people who commit suicide.
Yes, it does. Again, all of his friends, his coworkers talk about his past heroin addiction, which he kicked. One of the more interesting comments is a friend of his who also was an addict said, "Anthony's the only guy I've ever known that went cold turkey on heroin." And kicked it. Most people are not able to do that. So he kind of questions whether he really ever did get over this. And Bourdain had hinted about suicide his whole life, kind of, you know, chasing that thing, as they call. So it's very interesting. The sound bites are interesting. Bourdain's life is interesting. I just wasn't wild about some of the sleight of hand and the staging that was going on by Morgan Neville.
Well, obviously, he's very famous for his approach to food and to restaurants. A movie called Goodfellas.
Yes.
There's a famous restaurant scene. Where does Ray Liotta take Lorraine Bracco on their second date?
So you want a name of a restaurant?
I want the name of the restaurant in Goodfellas. That famous one-take shot where Scorsese follows him all the way through.
It's not Tavern on the Green, is it?
No.
I'm not real good at my New York restaurants.
Okay. It's also, well, I don't know if it's a real restaurant.
Oh, okay.
It's also a famous beach in Brazil.
Oh, Rio?
Copacabana.
The Copacabana. Okay. All right.
All right. We've been to the movies with Madeline.
This is Scott Prebis. I hope you will join us for a very special event Wednesday, August 11th at 7 p.m. when Prairie Public and the Sleepy Hollow Arts Park present A Night of Great Latin Jazz, featuring the charismatic hand drummer Scott Farkas, who will join a cadre of North Dakota's best jazz musicians in an evening of eye-popping Latin music. Oh, and be sure to embrace the evening with your tropical shirt, straw hat, and sandals. Now, tickets available at Eckroth Music or online at shtap.org. Seating available, but feel free to bring a lawn chair or a blanket. That's Wednesday, August 11th at 7 p.m., A Night of Great Latin Jazz.
Support for Dakota Datebook is provided by Books on Broadway and Dakota Soda and Coffee Company of Williston, featuring coffees and a wide variety of books for children and adults. Books on Broadway, the independent bookstore for independent minds.
This is Dakota Datebook for July 23rd. True simplicity in fishing consists of a bamboo cane pole, about 10 feet long, attached to a fishing line of about the same length, with a bobber, sinker, hook, and a wriggling worm. Sitting on a dock, riverbank, or the shore of a lake, pond, or stream, all you have to do is wait for your bobber to go down, and fun begins. In the deep past, a bamboo cane pole was every kid's starter rod, an introduction to the lifetime sport of fishing. Little line tangling, lots of panfish nibbling, much bobber watching, and all the delights of angling. On this date in 1903, an article in the Cooperstown Courier compared the qualities of a cane pole made of bamboo imported from Japan to those of an old-fashioned wooden pole made of hickory, ash, hazel, or willow. Quote, "Every country schoolboy is aware of the superiority of a bamboo fishing pole over any other. Its flexibility, lightness, and strength distinguish it sharply from any American pole and make it better suited for a fishing rod than one made from any wood grown in this country." The U.S. imported several million bamboo fishing rods every year, with perhaps 10 million from China and Japan sold by 1910. Generations of North Dakota kids dug in their gardens for enough angleworms and dirt to fill a tin can before heading to their favorite fishing hole, with bamboo pole in hand, out to catch bluegills, sunfish, pumpkin seeds, black crappies, or maybe even a bigmouth bass, a rip-roaring northern pike, or a keeper walleye. The anticipation of fishing was almost as sweet as watching the bobber go down. Those bobbers changed through the years, from bottle corks and balsa wood to red and white plastic balls, and most recently, foam slip bobbers that make it easy to adjust the depth of the bait. And that bait could be night crawlers or angleworms or grubs or grasshoppers or frogs or minnows or leeches, maybe even a kernel of corn. Whatever the bait, when the bobber went down, the joy came up. Isaac Walton said it best. We may say of angling, as Dr. Boteler said of strawberries, "Doubtless God could have made a better berry, but doubtless God never did. And so, if I might be the judge, God never did make a more calm, quiet, innocent recreation than angling. Doubtless, too, a bamboo starter pole could get a kid hooked on fishing." Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Dr. Steve Hoffbeck. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
Judy Chicago's The Dinner Party was groundbreaking feminist art, or vulgar, or both. The artist herself says now,
"As grateful as I was for all the attention it brought me, for a very long time it just obscured the rest of my work."
Judy Chicago talks about her work and her new autobiography, The Flowery. Saturday on Weekend Edition from NPR News.
7 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
That's it for this Friday edition of Main Street. Coming up Monday on the show, it's time for another episode of Philosophical Currents, where we take a deep philosophical dive at a story making headlines. And we do this with philosophy professor Dr. Jack Russell Weinstein from UND as he talks about critical race theory. As someone who is both a political philosopher and who has engaged with students debating the theory. That's coming up Monday on Main Street. Until then, enjoy the rest of your day.